Complaints about alleged excessive force by police officers have dominated national news since the summer. Now, a University of Iowa student has complaints of his own. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Grayson Scoggin says a recording of his arrest by campus police this year shows an officer using excessive force. We'll talk with him and hear excerpts from the video. Also in the program, a proposed $100 attorney fee to fund legal aid fuels debate, a conversation with Iowa's 2015 Teacher of the Year, and Iowa State University leads a new center for bioplastics and biocomposites. Buckle up for your news buzz after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up, a chat with Iowa's Teacher of the Year. But first, complaints about whether excessive force by police officers was justified have dominated national news since the summer. And now a University of Iowa student says a recording of his arrest by campus police shows an officer using excessive force on him. Grayson Scoggin posted a video a week ago today. Already, it has over 50,000 views, and we'll put it on our post of this show as well at iowapublicradio.org. The video was recorded by a police dashboard camera, and audio also picked up by the mic on the arresting officer, who was identified as Greg Hall, the video obtained by Scoggin's Journey. Grayson Scoggin joins me now by phone. Grayson Scoggin, welcome to our program.
Hi. It's wonderful to be here. I'm a big fan of IPR, and I really appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
Well, let's hear your account of what happened. I understand this is September 12th, very late, 2:30 in the morning on that Friday night. We have some audio of it, but please start off by telling us what happened that night.
Well, I had been out at the bars with a couple of my friends. We had been drinking, but really nothing excessive. And at the end of the night, we decided to walk home instead of drive. We weren't extremely intoxicated, but we thought it would be the best thing to do. And on the walk home, I'm at, I think, North Capitol Street in Burlington. And I come to it, and I see a police officer in the turn lane. So I obviously think that I should probably wait for the light to pass in this particular situation, just because I didn't want to cause any, distress that particular night. You know, who wants to jaywalk right in front of a police car? So when the light turns, the police car is actually in the turn lane. So I gave him the right of way, and I hadn't actually pressed the button yet. He approaches me directly, and I look at him, and he looks at me, and I'm kind of confused for about a second because he's not speaking to me or trying to get my attention in any real way. The window's not rolled down. So I decide to continue walking on. And then I'm walking down the street, and the next thing I know, I see the lights, and I presume that there was, in fact, something going on, and I hear some noise, and I think the officer is trying to get somebody else's attention, and I just want to get home and don't really want any part of it.
Let's listen to it. This is picking up at the point where the police officer now is out of the car and asking you to stop. Let's listen here a moment.
Hey, come here. We're going to be running here real shortly. Hey, come here. Hey. Stop. What are you doing? Okay, what do you think I was talking to you?
I'm not good to go.
No, you're not.
Okay, the officer saying, as identified as Greg Hall, saying, you say, am I free to go? And he says, no, you're not. So he comes up from behind you. What happens at that point? Because this is all on the dashboard camera. We put the link at iowapublicradio.org. What happens?
Well, I try to show him. We have a brief conversation, and I try to show him my ID. He is very angry that I went for my pockets in order to do so, and he swipes the wallet, which by that time was clearly a wallet in my hand, out of my hand, and he knocks it several feet away. And he's very angry about that. And I can understand that to some point. It was perhaps a mistake that I was trying to show him my ID. I was just trying to be accommodating.
Okay, let's listen to a bit of that audio that picks up from where we left off to the point about reaching into your pocket to get your ID.
Ready to go?
No, you're not.
Right in front of
the window. I was talking to you to see if you were okay. Okay. How much you had to drink tonight, guys?
I'm trying to walk home.
You're trying to walk home?
Have I made a disturbance?
Yeah, because I wanted to see if you were okay after your butt got hit by that car after wandering out in the middle of the street. Keep your hands out of your pocket.
Dude, what are you doing?
I'm trying to pull out my ID.
Don't stick your hands in your pockets on me at all. Don't ever do that.
I'm trying to walk home, sir.
Okay, okay.
His thought is that it's something dangerous to him.
I can understand that. I think enough time had elapsed that it was clearly a wallet. Regardless, it was, you know, I can understand the sentiment that you don't want to put your hands in your pockets when around a police officer. And I just haven't had much experience with police officers, and the thought really didn't enter my head. But once you made it clear, don't go for your pockets, didn't do it again at any point.
Okay, what happened after that?
The officer decided that he was going to arrest me, and I'm a little irritated because he said, you know, something I knew to be untrue, and I'm not irritated, I'm frustrated about it. And I asked him what I did wrong, and he basically decides that I'm going to be a violent person and throws me to the ground, even though I had displayed no violent behavior. I mean, so I'm body slammed to the ground, and then after a short while, he continues applying force after I had put my hands on my head, and I'm afraid, so I start yelling, my hands are on my head, just to make sure that he knew that I wasn't resisting him.
Okay, let's listen to that part. Let's listen to that part of the video.
Don't stick your hands in your pockets on me at all. Don't ever do that.
I'm trying to walk home, sir.
Okay, okay. Why don't you just put your hands on your back right now?
I'm a soldier.
I don't care. I'm just
saying. I haven't done anything wrong.
Sir,
what have I done wrong?
Don't fight me.
What have I done wrong, sir?
Campus for fighting?
No,
right there. Stop.
My hands are over my head. My hands are over my head. My hands are over my head. My hands are behind my head. My hands are behind my head.
Okay, my hands are behind my head, repeated probably over 20 times there. Other squad cars show up seconds later. You're on the ground with two or three officers on you?
Very quickly, it's two officers. And then I think I yelled, my hands are on my head, another 20 times or so.
Mm-hmm. Why did you continue to yell that?
Because they kept hurting me. They kept applying a tremendous amount of force. I'd call it wildly excessive, considering the fact that I was in the least violent position known to man.
Let's picture this. You're on your stomach with your hands behind your head.
You really can't do much from that position.
And what is the officer telling you?
He's not really telling me anything. He's pretty quiet throughout the entire time. Officer Greg Hall, in fact, never instructs me to put my hands anywhere else. He's just... I'm just sort of clueless. He's behind me, on top of me, just kind of hurting me and trying to tug me which way or, you know, every which way, and I don't really know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we get to the end of this in that you are cuffed and arrested. Several other patrol cars show up, and you are taken and you spend the night in the jail.
I am, yeah.
Okay. Well, after that, you go to the emergency room. You've sustained what kind of injuries?
The doctor said blunt force trauma to the chest. Essentially, that's bruised ribs, which doesn't really sound like a terrible injury. But for the first 5 days, I was pretty much unable to do anything but sit in a chair. It was extremely painful, and then it persisted for over a month. I also had like a number of like pretty significant bruises throughout the rest of my body. We got some very pictures of when they first incurred them, like 12 hours after, so they don't look like much, but they were quite severe at the end of the day.
Okay, we're talking with Grayson Scoggin, and he has put a YouTube video on saying what he says is excessive force used by University of Iowa campus police. You can see that video at iowapublicradio.org. We contacted, of course, the University of Iowa. Joe Brennan, the Vice President of Strategic Communications at the University of Iowa, declined our invitation to be part of this conversation. He said, quote, Mr. Scoggin is facing criminal charges in relationship to the incident for which university police were the arresting officers. It would not be appropriate for university officials to discuss this criminal case publicly at this time. So where are you legally at this time? What are you contending through your lawyer?
Well, legally, it's kind of funny because there's been a lot of changes in the past couple of days. Originally, I went to the University of Iowa Student Legal Services, and they were representing me. But as the matter has grown in publicity in recent days, the Public Defender's Office has contacted me and has expressed a desire to take on the case. And given that my attorneys at the University of Iowa think there might be a conflict of interest. They haven't expressed that they've been pressured whatsoever from the university in the slightest. In fact, I think they're just heading off any potential conflict of interest. They suggested that I go with a public defender.
So in legal terms, though, what are you contending? That you were unlawfully stopped, violating your rights?
Oh, yes. Legally, I believe that's the strategy. That's what we're contesting. The stop was illegal because the police officer was stopping me under the community caretaker exception, which is to say that the officer was stopping to see how I was doing. And then when I asked if I was free to go, he was unlawfully detaining me. That's really the argument that we're proposing.
Okay, so this is radio. We can't see your skin color. Do you believe your ethnicity had anything to do with this?
You know, it's kind of funny because I'm actually white, but I'm very tan, and I had just spent 6 months in the desert, so I was exceptionally tan at the moment, and I was walking, and I'm a big guy, too. I was walking down the street wearing a black hoodie, so it's very suspicious, especially considering the fact that I really wasn't hit by a car. I mean, all the evidence kind of points to that. You know, the video evidence certainly does.
What does a police report say about your ethnicity?
The police report says my ethnicity is Hispanic. I had actually been asked the question by the police officer, and I told him I was white, and for whatever reason, he put down Hispanic. And I don't have a drop of Hispanic blood in me, so it's not something I would have said.
Mm-hmm. You said in the interview, we heard in the audio, you said, I'm a soldier. Are you, in fact, a soldier?
I am, in fact, a soldier. I've been accused a lot of people by I've been accused by a lot of people of stolen valor lately, but I am a soldier. I've been in for a couple of years now, and I'm very proud to serve my country.
Now, let's talk about the release of the video. That only got mm-hmm. into your hands. Your lawyer got the release of the video from the University of Iowa police?
Yes. I had originally, before I had even contacted my lawyers, I had actually made the request for the video. So this was, I believe, the same day I got out of jail. I drafted a letter and sent it to the University of Iowa Police, the Iowa City Police, and the county attorney. So same day I got out of jail. And then by the time my lawyers took on the case, they were already immediately in contact with the county attorney. Because I had already requested this.
Now this
so we got the video.
This video on YouTube, getting many tens of thousands of views. Did your lawyer suggest you put it on YouTube as a strategy?
No, they did not. They I actually was really frustrated because the trial was supposed to originally be today, actually, and the county attorney failed to get back to my attorneys with the list of the police officers involved. So we had to request a continuation until March 6th. So I was very frustrated, and I sent an email to my attorneys asking, hey, can I post this video? Because, you know, I was going to tell my story whether it was before the trial or after, regardless. They said, hey, you know, let's look into the ethics of it. You know, you probably can. I don't know if it's a good idea. So they sent me that email back on Friday. I posted it without really getting an answer from them. And then on the following Monday, they emailed me and said, well, we saw you posted the video. So they didn't tell me whatsoever.
What are you looking at going forward? Do you have a new court date?
Yes, it's on March 6th, hoping to just have my day in court, and then I am fairly confident it'll be not guilty on both counts.
This all comes amidst finals. You have finals week coming up. Didn't expect that for your finals week.
No, it's been extremely disturbing to my studying for finals. I didn't plan for media interviews every day.
Okay. Grayson Scoggin, thank you for joining us. And again, we want to mention that we asked the University of Iowa to comment on this case. They declined our invitation to be part of this conversation. Grayson Scoggin, thank you for telling us your side of the story, and we'll be watching this case as it goes forward.
All right. Thank you again.
Once again, you can go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page to find a link to the approximately 3-minute video of the from the dash cam of that police vehicle. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a NewsBuzz edition of our program, as we like to do on Fridays. Iowa Legal Aid is a nonprofit organization. It provides legal assistance to low-income, vulnerable Iowans who have nowhere else to turn. In July, Iowa Legal Aid began campaigning for a proposal to require most Iowa attorneys to pay a yearly $100 fee in order to support the nonprofit's budget. And this has caused some debate. Joining us to talk about this proposal, Guy Cook, former president of the Iowa Bar Association, in our Des Moines studio. Full disclosure, Guy Cook is an Iowa Public Radio underwriter. Guy Cook, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Explain how is Iowa Legal Aid funded presently?
Well, it's really four sources, but primarily two or three: federal funds, state funds, and interest from lawyer trust accounts. What a lot of lay people might not realize is when money is put into a lawyer's trust account pending a transaction of some sort, the interest on that account is harvested but not given to the parties or the lawyers. It goes into a fund that's used to support legal services for those in need.
Mm-hmm. And revenue to Iowa Legal Aid has been going down recently. Why?
Well, significantly dwindling resources for legal services to persons in need, particularly legal aid. And here are the facts. In 2013, Iowa Legal Aid and Volunteer Lawyer Projects handled in excess of 18,000 cases, helped over 43,000 people, and more than 18,500 were children. Despite the number of people that were helped, more than 13,500 were turned away. And the dwindling resources has affected Legal Aid's ability to maintain its staff. It's really shocking to know that in real dollars, the amount of money that the federal government provides to Legal Aid is less now than it was when I began practicing law 30 years ago.
Mm. So talk about this proposal. What is it?
Well, the proposal is threefold and grows out of work that the ISBA, the Bar Association, did to committed to access to justice. We had a committee, Access to Justice, headed by Bruce Walker of Iowa City. It prepared a report. They met 9 times and said, maybe there's a way to tax out-of-state lawyers who come here one time for a case and are admitted under what's called a pro hoc vice admission. And maybe there's an opportunity to have lawyers fund this, either mandatory or voluntary. And certainly we should increase our lobbying efforts to see that the state funds and the federal funds are increased, because lawyers have a special duty and responsibility as officers of the court in our ethical code to provide pro bono or legal services to those who cannot pay. So that went forward, and at the same time or thereafter, Iowa Legal Aid specifically asked for an assessment each time a lawyer is licensed each year, renewing their license, of $100. And so that now is out for public comment until the first part of January. The Supreme Court is taking comment. And the Bar Association, as you might imagine, there are different views within our association. And there are people in favor of it and people against it.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that the pro argument you've pretty much spelled out is that there's an ethical duty to provide access to justice regardless of your economic class here. What
What is the argument against the proposal, chiefly?
Well, back to the argument for it for just a moment. The lawyers do have a special duty and a significant shortfall, and we have this ethical obligation in the Iowa Code that actually says every lawyer, regardless of professional prominence or workload, has a responsibility to provide legal services to those unable to pay. It's really an access to justice question. Those who are against it aren't necessarily against helping those in need. They're against the notion of this being mandatory, and they say it's a tax on one group to benefit another. People have said it's a slippery slope because the lawyers take this responsibility on and maybe the legislature steps away. Some people have said it's forced charity. Some people have said that it's, and probably is true, it's a regressive tax on young lawyers who are just entering the practice. And then there are people who say that one profession shouldn't shoulder a societal problem. Doctors are not asked to, for example, support and pay for Medicare. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the arguments against it. The issue is actually laid out pretty clearly on our website, which is iowabar.org, where former Lieutenant Governor, State Senator Art New has a brief essay in support of it, and former Iowa Bar President Joe Holland of Iowa City has an essay against it. The bottom line is how can we as lawyers help access to justice, which is sorely needed in terms of the funding that has dwindled?
Don't you also have to say that we all know roughly that lawyers are in the upper tier of income earners here? $100 fee per year is less than a pittance for a lawyer in Iowa, isn't it?
Right, and that's some of the arguments in favor of it, the amount of money that the lawyers are being asked to give, relatively speaking, as you said. And so I think for many people, though, it's not the dollar amount so much. It is the policy question here of forcing lawyers to do this, which would seem to be consistent with our public service requirements under the ethical code. How does that get implemented?
Mm-hmm. Can we look to other states as to guides? Has this been implemented anywhere else?
It has been in 8 other states. This particular option to fund legal aid has been done, and most of those are in the Midwest that have a mandatory fee when licenses are renewed for lawyers. So if this was done, we would be in the same group as those states, for example, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, Missouri, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
You said the Supreme Court, Iowa Supreme Court, taking public comment until when?
Public comment is being taken until the first part of January. They have until January 5th to receive comments. They've received hundreds of emails, letters, and so forth on the subject, and then they will decide whether this fee should be entered. If it should be, should it be mandatory or should it be sort of a checkoff?
Okay. Guy Cook, we have to go. Former president of the Iowa Bar Association, thank you for explaining this to us. The Iowa Legal Aid's campaign for a requirement for most Iowa attorneys to pay a $100 fee to support the nonprofit's budget. Guy Cook, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, your Friday News Buzz continues here on Iowa Public Radio. We'll talk with a woman who began her teaching career in Ecuador and eventually made her way to Des Moines and has just been named the 2015 Iowa Teacher of the Year. A conversation with her when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A woman who began her teaching career in Ecuador and eventually made her way to Des Moines has been named the 2015 Iowa Teacher of the Year. Clemencia Spuzeri is...
Good morning, Ben Kiefer. Thank you.
Oh, welcome to you. I wanted to mention you are a teacher at Merrill Middle School in Des Moines, and you were awarded the honor last week by Governor Branstad. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. It's actually, yes, truly an honor to be able to represent all the wonderful teachers in Iowa. There are so many deserving teachers, so I am really feeling humbled and honored.
Mm. Let me mention a couple things about your background. This is very interesting. You've been teaching Spanish at Merrill Middle School in Des Moines for 5 years. You live in Waukee with your husband and 3 children.
your childhood spent in Ecuador, where you grew up. You're the youngest of seven children. Tell us a little bit about that upbringing.
Well, actually, it was very interesting because I was the baby of the family. So I think that all my siblings always tried to teach me something. Like, for example, my oldest sibling, brother, actually, Gonzalo, he had a huge bookcase with plenty of books. And I remember my favorite were his National Geographic magazines. And I used to read them, and I couldn't understand them very well because the writing level was higher. I was just like five. Mm-hmm. But he bought set of encyclopedias or dictionaries for me to look for the words that I could look for the meaning of the word and be able to understand. And they always encouraged me to learn. And I think that it was really amazing. I had an amazing childhood.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to the United States then?
In 2003, actually, I was finally able to obtain a visa. The economical situation in my country was really overwhelming. And if you check the history, actually, in our currency changed to the American dollar. We even lost our currency, like half of our population immigrated to Spain, and few of us who were lucky were able to come to the USA.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the reasons that I came here.
Tell us a little bit more about your upbringing and how that has shaped your views on education, because it really ties in with working with children today, even refugees, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it does. I can tell you that when I was born in Quito, the capital of Ecuador, and growing up in the admixed and bustling capital city with an impressive fusion of history and culture and ethnicities provided me with a unique perspective about the importance of cultural responsive teaching, because you can see numbers of kids working on the streets. And then I always was wondering, you know, why education has to be a privilege here when it should be a right for children. So that was pretty much my inspiration when I saw them, because I wanted to help everybody. I wanted to do something to change that situation.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean, the phrase you used? Explain that a little bit. Cultural responsive teaching.
Well, we are educating global citizens who are upholding views about, you know, different backgrounds, different people, global learners. And I think that that's what education and our Department of Education stands for, global citizens who are multicultural learners who are able to be engaged in their own education and discovery of their own learning. It's how our students are directly invested in the discovery of their own knowledge, and they are becoming long-life learners who respect and understand other cultures and languages.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean with
So in your Des Moines classroom at Merrill Middle School, how do you go about that? What is a lesson plan that communicates what you just said?
Well, for example, right now, we have a lesson plan, a unit that is called Does Anyone Really Know What Time Is It? And it doesn't really talk just about learning how to tell time in Spanish, but we actually talk about how other cultures view time. Because time is relative, and it depends on where you live and where you come from. And we talk about different cultures that sometimes don't even have time, and how time is man-made and what time really means in our culture. So we develop on the social-emotional learning of them, too, because they have classmates who come from different countries as refugees or as immigrants, so they can be more culturally responsive when they have a classmate who have not the same views about time and what is to be on time, because it depends on where you come from.
Mm-hmm. Now, administrators said in you receiving this award that you're known for helping needy children, families in poverty, and helping those families and children understand the importance of education. How do you go about that?
Well, I try my best always, and that's why I always, in my message, I said, as teachers, we always have to strive for continuous improvement and be enthusiastic and embrace challenges. And what I did was that last summer, I was volunteering for an organization called Alexito, and we piloted a class called Juntos Together. to empower the Latino community, especially the parents, and help them to learn and understand how the educational system works here, because many times people think that, well, these parents never show up to a meeting or to this conference, so they must not care. And the truth is that they do care about education. It's just that sometimes the language can be a barrier, and sometimes also they don't know how things work. And it was very successful. Mm-hmm. And also how I go about that with my students who are not Latinas, because I advocate for everybody. And with them, what I do is work one-on-one and show them what are the different options that they have for their education, like, for example, applying for gifted and talented programs if they have not been identified, or go to the science bound or upper bound, and also continue advocating with different teachers and talking and doing follow-ups and finding volunteers who can mentor them when they go to high school.
Mm-hmm. I understand that teaching about diversity is important to you. What specifically about diversity do you want to bring across?
Well, I would like to bring across mostly how we can respect and understand other cultures. So show empathy. I think that that's crucial. Our social emotional learning and how we transfer that learning to different areas in our life is crucial. Mm-hmm. Because when we do that, actually we erase our differences somehow, and then we can see more what we have in common and we can work together.
Mm-hmm. And in the classroom, you teach empathy. How?
Well, with the lessons that we have, many times we have to share our own experiences, and that is the connection that is so important with the students. Many times I share experiences with them about my students in Ecuador and my own learning experiences, and we have such a relationship that they also share with me their experiences, and they are truly IB learners who show that they are caring, principled, balanced, reflective, open-minded thinkers. And then we have a level of respect here at Merrill that is amazing. Mm. And then, yes, they learn empathy through sharing different situations, different scenarios, learning from different cultures.
You mentioned your brother helping you out as a youngster, a young girl in Ecuador. Who else in your life made sure that education was a focal point?
Well, my parents. My parents, and I can tell you that growing up in a country where education is, it used to be a privilege. Right now I think that it is changing a little bit, which is great. And I think that right now, I haven't been in my country for the last 7 years, but when I read the news, I hear good news, and I hope that it's true. But my parents, they were big advocators for education. They always told me, you know what, you can have money, but you know your money can be taken away. You can have possessions, and your possessions can be taken away, especially when you come from a country that usually has political problems going on. And they always taught me that, you know what, but your education, nobody will take that away. Mm. So that is the way to succeed, because you can bring your education everywhere. That's going to be your treasure.
Clemencia, as Teacher of the Year, you will travel the state talking with others. Being an ambassador for education, what are you most looking forward to this coming year?
Well, I am looking forward to serve as an ambassador for all the wonderful teachers of Iowa. And I'm going to share how IB highlights, IB and SRG actually, that are two wonderful initiatives in our district, how they highlight the standards of Iowa Core by promoting the characteristics of effective instruction and meaningful learning experiences for students.
Mm. Clemencia Spuzieri, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations again as the 2015 Iowa Teacher of the Year. We appreciate your time, and I imagine you have to get back to class pretty soon.
Yes. That is correct.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Coming to the end of our hour, it's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We want to squeeze in a couple more short conversations, as we like to have on our News Buzz edition, before we end the hour. This is a next news story somewhere, Iowa, making national news also, looking to create the nation's first smartphone driver's license with an app that can coexist with the traditional plastic card. Mm. The app is currently in development for Apple and Android phones, expected to be free. Mark Lowe is with us, director of the Motor Vehicle Division of the Department of Transportation. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How will this work? What can you say about it at this point? I understand it's in development.
Yeah, I think that's one thing to be very clear on. We are now moving from concept into development, and we're going to step that out slowly with small groups of internal users and then ultimately move to customers. But our concept on how it would work is that once we've vetted somebody's identity and approved them for an Iowa driver's license or ID card, they could choose to use the app, and they would access that like you would use any other app. But we would, in this instance, because it needs to be a secure relationship, we would issue them a PIN that says that they're authorized to download that app. And then within the app, their access to that would be controlled, and they would control it and sort of lock out others from using it by choosing to associate a biometric with the app that allows them to open that up. So that would be something like a fingerprint, or a facial image recognition, or potentially even voice or iris imagery, but something that says that I'm accessing this based on who I am, not what I know, if that makes sense.
Now, this would be in addition to the traditional plastic card, or could it, or will it, as planned, replace the traditional plastic card if I would leave my plastic card at home, for instance?
Right. I think ultimately the idea would be that as people become comfortable with it, they can choose to use this instead of or in lieu of the traditional plastic card. I think that, you know, our initial concept is that you have to go through a transition period and you have to go through a comfort level period. And so we definitely want it to be based on customer choice. And we definitely want it to sort of evolve as people become more comfortable using it, again, in lieu of a more traditional card.
What are the advantages of going this direction?
Well, the real advantage, I think a couple of advantages. First is, one, it's responsive to a sort of an evolving way that customers want to use their mobile devices and obtain services and carry and share information. The other piece, though, I think very much long-term is that it transitions something that has for a long time just been a static thing that's in your pocket and now creates an ongoing relationship that lets customers sort of choose and control how they receive services and receive them in much more effective ways. So if you think about that digital driver's license is now being an app that's something the customer can use and that we can connect to them securely, now they can leverage that to reach out and obtain other services or choose to receive information that we may need to push to them regarding changes in their license, changes in their record, changes in their vehicle registrations, or things like traffic alerts, weather alerts, amber alerts, other emergency information, as well as be able then to share and verify their identity with people if they choose to. So long-term, what we really think is that it creates an ongoing customer relationship and really transforms the way that we interact with customers.
Mark Lowe, we have a couple minutes left. I want to get down to some of the concerns that I'm sure have popped into the heads of the people listening here. Let's give you a scenario out of my head. I'm pulled over by a police officer. I give him my smartphone as my to show my app that is my driver's license, and a text pops up. How can you prevent it from being abused, for instance, in that way?
Yeah, I think that's one of the very important things when you listen to the voice of the customer about the things that they're concerned about. That privacy aspect is very important, still being able to interact with law enforcement. So as we're thinking through what the development of this should be, one of the clear functions should be able to say, I'm going to hit a button that says share. And when I share, I can display my license on the screen, but it's going to allow the person looking at it only to see that, not to access anything else in the phone, and not to let messages pop through. So to me, that's one of those things you have to be sensitive to and you have to build towards, but it's not an insurmountable obstacle.
Mm-hmm. How much will this cost quickly?
Right now, we think our initial pilot will be well under $50,000. I think once we get into it, we'll have a chance to evaluate what the long-term cost will be. It will certainly, as you look at shifting from the permanent license, shift some things that we've invested in physical resources and moving physical resources into maintaining more of a service concept. So that will be something to be evaluated. But we really think that overall the value return will definitely warrant the cost.
Okay, so Iowa drivers can expect this when, or don't you know?
Yeah, right now we're focusing in the next 6 months on our first user group, which we're going to keep small and internal, primarily state employees. We think the state-issued iPhones and probably primarily DOT employees. And I think over the next 6 months, we'll try to get those working prototypes into their hands and then spend some period of time evaluating their use and use case scenarios. So, you know, later in the year, moving into 2016, I think is when we start to look at have we proven enough success and developed to the point that we would then say we're going to release this to customers.
Mark Lowe, Director of the Motor Vehicle Division of the Iowa Department of Transportation. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And finally today, a new research center at Iowa State University partnering with other universities and companies to develop new products from crops. Joining us quickly to talk about that, Dave Gruel, professor in agriculture and biosystems engineering and director of the Center for Bioplastics and Biocomposites at Iowa State University. Dave Gruel, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you very much, and I appreciate the time.
You better tell us, first off, what are biocomposites and bioplastics?
Well, the number of different people may have different definitions, but my spin on this is any material that has some type of bio content to it. And that could be either 100% or a significant portion of it being from a natural or renewable feedstocks. You know, that can include things like the lumber that you see on decking, that's recycled plastics that have wood fillers in them to some extent, to anything that's 100% bio-based, something like PLA that you see some of the food packaging being made out of. So it's a broad range of different materials. Some of them are can be composted and break down. Other ones are not.
And a lot of our plastics right now, you talked about deck material, that's derived from petroleum?
Well, some of it is. Some of the decking materials is recycled plastics, and they have bio-based fillers in there, you know, something to the extent of wood flour and so on. And so that encompasses it. So when we say bioplastics, I think some people have the idea or preconception that it's exclusively something that's like PLA, that's 100% corn-based. And when we look at bioplastics and biocomposites, that's not necessarily true. If we look at what Coca-Cola, for example, is doing, they have a bio-based PET, and that's polyethylene terephthalate. And so your drink bottles are primarily made out of this material, and over the last many years, it's been made of 100% feedstock from oil and petroleum-based materials. Over the last couple of years, though, Coca-Cola has been pioneering the technology to have that be at least a portion of that being bio-based. So one-third of these pop bottles being produced right now has a bio-based component, and Coke is going to be pushing forward, and over the next few years, it's going to be 100% bio-based PET.
Of course.
We're
running short of time, a couple minutes here. I just wanted to make sure that we understand. So in the environment, we always worry about plastics in our environment, in our oceans. Does this help with that problem? Do these type of plastics break down easier, pose less of a threat to the environment because they come from crops and so forth?
Some of them do, some of them don't. You know, for example, the bio-based PET, it would not. That's a material that's going to land up being a one-to-one drop-in. But what you're doing is you're capturing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and you're storing that into that PET bottle. Now, you could put that into the landfill, and that may not necessarily be the best thing, but what you could do, though, is then burn that and capture the energy that you've already invested into making that pop bottle and reusing that. So now you've released it back into the CO2, back in the atmosphere of CO2, and so it's a net zero balance.
Okay. How is this being funded?
We're partially funded through the National Science Foundation through an IOCRC program, which is a industry university cooperative research center. And those funds go to pay for overhead and administrative costs. And then on the other side, we get industry money. And that way, 100% of the money that's coming from industry lands up going to funding the research. And it doesn't pay for buildings or infrastructure to any, to that extent. As we were going through the program and getting funded, it's a two-year program. We were vetted in terms of showing that we had the equipment, we had the people and everything. And that way, all the money that goes from industry goes to pay for graduate students, researchers, undergraduates, and materials. And those companies, you know, are things like ADM and 3M and Boeing and Ford and Hyundai and Rubbermaid and so on. And right now we have about 23 member companies.
Mm-hmm. So your goal, 5, 10, 20 years down the line, that Iowa State University and this new center will be the global center for this type of production?
I would hope to be that what we will see is Iowa State will be the lead institution. When people think of bioplastics and biocomposites, they think of Iowa State, and that we're the center of the universe of bioplastics, and we're the place that's going to be developing the technology and distributing that out so that in the future people and industries and consumers feel comfortable with these new and novel materials as they're coming out.
Very quickly, how much is there still to discover about these crop-based materials? A lot of territory?
There's a huge amount of territory. Even right now, as we speak, the consumers out there are very—it's very loose defined as what is bio-based, what is compostable, what is biodegradable. So just even the terminology itself is not well established, so that the consumers are not well informed from the industry as to what that means. So we are very early on in this technology.
Okay.
And so
we have to go, Dave Gruelle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to developments in this area. Dave Gruelle, professor in agriculture and biosystems engineering, director of the Center for Bioplastics and Biocomposites at Iowa State University. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Monday on the program, we'll talk about CIA interrogation techniques with an ISU psychologist, Christian Meissner. We want to tune in for that. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.